But open your Bibles to the book of Psalms. We are going to be looking at Psalm 16 tonight. Psalm 16. And I want to begin just by reading the passage in question. Psalm 16. Preserve me, O God, for I take refuge in you. I said to the Lord, you are my Lord. I have no good besides you. Oh, as for the saints who are in the earth, they are the majestic ones in whom is all my delight. The sorrows of those who have bartered for another god will be multiplied. I shall not pour out their drink offerings of blood, nor will I take their names upon my lips. The Lord is the portion of my inheritance and my cup. You support my lot. The lines have fallen to me in pleasant places. Indeed, my heritage is beautiful to me. I will bless the Lord who has counseled me. Indeed, my mind instructs me in the night. I have set the Lord continually before me. Because he is at my right hand, I will not be shaken. Therefore, my heart is glad, my glory rejoices. My flesh also will dwell securely, for you will not abandon my soul to Sheol, nor will you allow your Holy One to undergo decay. You will make known to me the path of life. In your presence is fullness of joy. In your right hand there are pleasures forever. This is what we refer to as a psalm of trust. The idea of the psalm of trust being, well, pretty self-explanatory. This psalm is expressing the writer's trust in the Lord. And almost every line in this psalm expresses trust in God in some way, although with one exception where he stops to talk about idolaters and how horrible they are. And you look at this, what's going on here, the psalmist explores really kind of what we're looking at here is an expansion of an idea that was in Psalm 2. As I've tried to point out variously as we talk about the Psalms, we're looking at some explorations of ideas or difficulties produced by the first two Psalms. And Psalm 2 and verse 12 in particular makes this statement, how blessed are all who take refuge in Him. Well, how does this Psalm begin? Preserve me, O God, for I take refuge in you. In other words, you know, since you made that promise, since those who take refuge in the Lord are promised to be blessed, it goes as a self-evident idea that the Lord should preserve me if I take refuge in Him. He should bless me if I take refuge in Him. David is taking refuge in the Lord, and now he is making this point of appeal to the Lord's promise, if you will. In fact, this is not the first time that the book of Psalms has done this. Psalm 7 and verse 1. O Lord, my God, in you I have taken refuge. Save me from all those who pursue me and deliver me. Again, in Psalm 11, in verse 1, in the Lord I take refuge. How can you say to my soul, flee as a bird to your mountain? And a little bit later, actually in the next psalm, in Psalm 17, in verse 7, wondrously show your loving kindness, O Savior, of those who take refuge at your right hand from those who rise up against them. And the idea, you know, is that there's all these people that are out to get you, these enemies who want to destroy you. But the Lord is the source of refuge. He is the safe place. He is the secure fortress in which one can find their protection. But are people who take refuge in God really blessed? Are they really happy? Is it a lasting blessing? David trusts that it is, and this trust, it seems to me, it goes to great lengths in this psalm. The prayer for preservation implies that there's some kind of crisis. Yes, you know, preserve me. I am trusting in you. I'm taking refuge in you. You know, one wonders, you know, when do you pray a prayer like this? Well, usually when something bad is happening. Usually when you have a reason to ask God to preserve you. Usually you don't ask God to preserve you in something unless you're afraid of, well, perishing. But we don't know the background. We don't know what specific crisis precipitated this. We actually don't know the background of most of the Psalms. And perhaps the fact that it's not there might be intentionally make the Psalm applicable to a number of circumstances. God has made this promise. Blessed are all who take refuge in Him. And David calls on God to keep that promise and all that it implies. The way that this psalm describes God makes it evident why he trusts in the Lord. I mean, it's one thing to trust God, but it's another thing to reflect on just who God is. And when we reflect on who God is, and when we describe him and the kinds of things he does, we have a reason to trust him. Look at how he describes the Lord. In verse 2, you are my Lord, or my master. This is one of those weird instances where the Lord in all caps and Lord in not all caps are distinct from each other. Lord meaning master, and the all caps version being a translation of the word Yahweh. In this case, Yahweh is his master. A little bit later, in verse 5, he describes him as his portion, his cup, his inheritance. What does it mean to describe God as our master? Is that a cold term? Is that a disconnected term? Does it imply some kind of distance in our relationship with him? Well, here David uses it to describe his dependence on God. And it makes it point, you know, in the next line of verse 2, you are my Lord, I have no good besides you. There's no good that exists apart from Yahweh. Why not call him our master? Somebody might say, you know, well, some people refuse to submit to anybody. Some people refuse to be subject to anybody or call anybody master. So why call Yahweh our master? Well, the simple reason David gives is because there's no good besides him. He's the true source of all your benefits. There's no good thing that happens in your life that you cannot trace back to the Almighty in some way. And even people who might say, oh, well, you know, I have all this good stuff happening in my life, and, you know, I can't... They refuse to give God credit for any of it. But it is God who made their lungs, made air to breathe in and out of it. It is God who made their heart. It is God who made their mind. It is God who made their skin that contains all of these things. It is God who gave them circumstances and the opportunities that would lead to whatever they could call joy in life. And so even the atheist, even the agnostic, even the one who just wants to deny that God has any good in this world, has to ultimately trace his good back to the Lord. I have no good besides you. That's a statement that we need to acknowledge and realize in our life. Don't forget. Acknowledge what is good, but don't forget where it comes from. Besides him, we have nothing but good. As Asaph later wrote in Psalm 73 and verse 25, whom have I in heaven? You. There's nothing on earth I desire but you. In describing the reasons to trust God, his refuge, and his life, in verses 3 and 4, we have a kind of a contrast between two groups of people. The saints who are in the earth, or the holy ones, and in verse 4, the people who are chasing after the idols. Now, verse 3, the delight in God's people, the holy ones in the land, give David delight. We talked about this a little bit in Bible class this morning. In the New Testament, you know, you see the word saints a lot. Saints is related to our English word sanctified. And saints just basically means holy ones. Here it's that same idea that these saints who are in the earth, these holy ones, they are the ones in whom David delights. They are the majestic ones. Which I think is kind of interesting, you know. David delight in his fellow Israelites? I mean, you think about it, most of the problems in David's life came from who? You might think of the battles he had with the Philistines, but the real battles David had to fight were with people of his own nation. Saul, Ishbosheth, Joab, Amnon, Absalom, Sheba, all those people, they were all Israelites. They were all fellow countrymen of his. You know, one might be suspect, you know, David's kind of gotten a little tired of this at some point. In fact, there's a scene in 1 Samuel where he appears to defect to the Philistines in some way. But David still delights in the company of God's people. He still delights in the Lord's true holy ones. As he later writes in Psalm 119, in verse 63, I am a companion of all who fear you, of those who keep your precepts. And it challenges us a little bit too. Do we take delight in the people of God? Because that's part of trusting in the Lord. It's not just, you know, trust, I'm going to go out and, you know, be an individual person who pulls myself up by my bootstraps and trusts in the Lord and doesn't need any help from anybody, anywhere, anyhow. Well, you do kind of need the Lord's people. I mean, and trusting in the Lord necessarily entails keeping company with the people of God. What else do we really trust in the Lord? What's the alternative? You're going to keep company with somebody. You can keep company with the holy ones of God, or you can keep company with the other group, the group that runs to the idols in verse 4. And this is the verse in verse 4 where he really breaks from speaking of his trust in God to talking about the idolaters. The New American Standard talks about the sorrows of those who have bartered for another god, although perhaps a better translation of that Hebrew term is to run after, which is what it means almost everywhere else it appears. The only passage where it refers to transaction or bartering is when it talks about paying bridal prices in Exodus 22. But the point here is that David is calling down a curse on those who chase after other gods. Let their sorrows be multiplied. Some render it declarative, their sorrows will be multiplied. But here the idea, their sorrows be multiplied. They've chased after these sorrows. This word for sorrows, similar to another term that refers to idols, it's also the same word in Genesis 3 where you talk about pain in childbirth and pain and working for the fruit of the ground. David prays for their sorrows to be multiplied. And he further takes an oath on himself, I will not pour out their drink offerings of blood. I will not take their names upon my lips. These holy ones, whom David delights in, are contrasted with those who chase another god and pour out a blood drink offering. And of course, there's a huge amount of discussion about what the blood drink offering refers to. Is it talking about human sacrifice? Is it talking about sacrifices that have just been tainted by the bloodshed that they commit elsewhere? Is it talking about some other pagan ritual? I don't really know which of those options is correct. Maybe some combination of them. Maybe he's ambiguous on purpose. The point is that David, he trusts in the Lord. He won't keep company with the idolaters. He won't participate in what they love. He won't invoke the names of their gods. He will not praise them. He will not even mention them, because they are such false gods. And if you're not going to keep company with the idolaters, if you're not going to trust in the idols, if you're not going to invoke the names of the false gods, then what's your alternative? Who do you keep company with? Who do you take delight in? Well, you must by necessity take comfort and delight in the holy ones of God. Hence the point of verses 3 and 4. And so, in a roundabout way, who you keep company with is reflective of where you put your trust. And David expressing that he takes delight in the Lord's Holy One is his way of trusting in the Lord. One such way of expressing his trust. But David is not done. In verse 5, the Lord is the portion, the cup, my inheritance. Some versions try to smooth it out by saying he gives us our portion. He gives us our cup. And we'll talk about this idea of being a portion. What does it mean for somebody to be a portion? The most common usage of this term is to refer to a portion of land, an inheritance of a tract of land. Although there is one place where it definitely refers to a portion of a sacrifice, in Leviticus 6 and verse 17. There may be some sense in which, this is a metaphor for sustenance as well. He talks about providing him a portion, providing him a cup. It's almost like kind of what you get in Psalm 23, where he prepares a table in the presence of the enemies, and the cup overflows, and the Lord is providing sustenance. Of course, there's maybe a double meaning here. I may be talking about both our land inheritance and our portion and sustenance. And since the land that you lived in is inevitably the place where you get your food back then, it's not hard to imagine the two ideas being conflated together. Of course, we can think of how the Lord himself is our portion and our cup, even when we eat and drink of his body and blood in the Lord's Supper today. So it's not entirely unthinkable that the Lord would describe himself in that way. But he's also described as our inheritance. There's an idea. If you read the Law of Moses, it's the Levites who have the Lord as their inheritance. God promised in various places, in Numbers and in Deuteronomy, that the Levites would not receive a land inheritance because the Lord himself would be their inheritance. Instead of giving them a portion of land, God himself would be their portion. But David was not a Levite, and he still calls Yahweh his inheritance. He still calls Yahweh his portion. So what's going on here? Well, of course, he sees that he recognizes, it's again an outgrowth of the truth that we already saw in verse 2. I have no good besides you. And may I say that Yahweh is our inheritance as well. There's a sense in which we have an inheritance laid up in heaven for us, yes, but we have received a pledge of that inheritance. We have received a down payment of that inheritance. Ephesians chapter 1 and verses 13 and 14 describes God's Spirit as our down payment of that inheritance. The presence of God dwelling within us. Well, the down payment of an inheritance in which, until the day when we inherit eternity in His presence. You see, I mean, when we talk about God being our inheritance, you know, we think of inheritance as like riches or something, you know, having a bigger bank account or having gold coins or things like that. Or we think of inheritance as a land you might inherit or a house you might inherit or some other thing or possession you might inherit. But the inheritance that God offers us, the greatest treasure that God has to offer us, is His own presence, Himself. He Himself is the inheritance. And the whole point of heaven isn't the golden streets and the pearly gates and the nice things that you're going to have when you get there. It's not, you know, the flashy stuff. It's the fact that God Himself is there. His presence is there. The tabernacle of God is among men. And we dwell there. We're a part of that. And in return for God giving us Himself, what do we give? Well, we give ourselves. It's the biggest gift we have to offer, because God has given us the greatest gift He could give us. Look at verses 7 and 8. I will bless the Lord who has counseled me. Indeed, my mind instructs me in the night. I have set the Lord continually before me. Because He is at my right hand, I will not be shaken. Now we have another reason to trust God. He is a guide. He is a counselor. He gives, this idea of a source of counsel, guidance, good advice. Even in the second part of verse 7 is always kind of interesting. You know, that my mind instructs me in the night. Well, you know, what does that mean? My heart or my mind instructs me. It's just, you know, is truth determined based on what I feel? Is that what it is? Well, no. It's this idea here is more, again, God's instruction, reflections on what God has said and what God has done. Kind of an outplaying of an idea we saw in an earlier psalm, in Psalm 1 and verse 2. That the righteous man finds delight in the law of the Lord, and in His law he meditates day and night. And another thing that perhaps to note here, in the Hebrew the word nights, my mind instructs me in the nights, actually it's plural, although most versions do not render it that way. Some people suggested it could mean something along the lines of throughout the nights. You know, a metaphorical way of describing how God guides him even when the times are dark, even when things are difficult. The Lord still gives guidance even in the times of darkness. Well, regardless of how you read that, you know, the point is that, you know, he's finding joy in God's presence. Now, there are some throwbacks, if you will, to Psalm 13. Consider me and answer me, O Lord my God. Enlighten my eyes, or I will sleep the sleep of death. There's that prayer for God to be counselor. In Psalm 13, in verse 4, my enemy will say, I've overcome him. My adversaries will rejoice when I am shaken. But he says, well, because I have the Lord, Psalm 16, I will not be shaken. And, of course, Psalm 13, in verse 5, I've trusted in your loving kindness. My heart shall rejoice in your salvation. Well, here is the same thing. Verse 9 of Psalm 16, my heart is glad and my glory rejoices. My flesh also will dwell securely. David is, he has this idea here, you know, that he wants to be in God's presence forever. And because he wants to be in God's presence forever, he sets God before him now. That needs to be our perspective. You want to be in God's presence forever? Set God before you now. No, don't get caught up in the distractions of this world. Don't get caught up putting your trust in things that aren't the Lord. Set Him before you even now. Meditate on Him now. That's the joy of heaven is available to those who are, well, trying to do the things that will already be there. We know that, I mean, if we're trying to find the presence of God, the people who go to heaven won't be the people who didn't care about God. You know, because what's going to be in heaven that they want? God's there. But they already said they didn't want God. No, the Lord has promised His presence to those who want to be there with Him. When God is at someone's right hand, there's an interesting idiom there. You know, He is at my right hand, I will not be shaken. And every time you see God described as being at someone's right hand, it describes kind of protection from difficulties. You know, there's several instances of this in Psalm 73, in verse 23, for instance. It says that, nevertheless, I am continually with you. You have taken hold of my right hand. With your counsel, you will guide me. Afterward, receive me to glory. Psalm 109, verse 31. He stands at the right hand of the needy to save him from those who judge his soul. Psalm 110, in verse 5. The Lord is at your right hand. He will shatter kings in the day of his wrath. He will judge among the nations. He will fill them with corpses. He will shatter the chief men over a broad valley. So then, you have this idea of God fighting battles on your behalf. And that's what it's like to be at his right, to have him at your right hand, to have him available. That's what it means to have God in your presence. And since God is in his presence and always protects him, he will not be shaken. You know, you look back one psalm to Psalm 15, you have the same idea, describing that man who wants to ascend into the hill of the Lord, who wants to do all these different things. You know, he walks with integrity, he works righteousness, he speaks truth in his heart, he does not slander with his tongue, he does not do evil to his neighbor, take up reproach against a friend, etc., etc., does not put out his money at interest, does not take a bribe against the innocent. He who does these things will never be shaken. Verse 5. That's the same idea here in Psalm 16. The Lord is at my right hand. I put the Lord continually in my presence. I will not be shaken. The idea of being shaken, not referring to convulsions necessarily, but so much as the idea of being destabilized, being removed, allowing enemies to have their way with you. Once again, the result of taking refuge in God, of taking refuge in His holy mountain, of taking refuge in the righteousness that He calls upon us each to possess, these things prevent us from being shaken. How blessed are all who take refuge in Him. But the most profound statement about his trust in the Lord is still yet to come. In verse 9, my heart is glad, my glory rejoices, my flesh also will dwell securely. Why does God's presence give us joy? Does God's presence give us joy? You look at it. Trust in God is the motivation for our praise. We love Him. We trust Him to do what He says. We thank Him. We praise Him for giving us such confidence. And He says we will dwell securely in our flesh. That's pretty bold. I mean, do you worry about anything? Anybody here worry about stuff? Anybody here feel like they dwell securely? Where does such peace of mind come from? Well, verse 10, you will not abandon my soul to Sheol, nor will you allow your Holy One to undergo decay. I think we've talked about Sheol before. Sheol was the realm of the dead. It was, we might say, the grave. You will not abandon me to death, to the grave. You will not allow your Holy One to undergo decay. And although they are not the same term in Hebrew, it is interesting to me that the psalmist takes delight in God's Holy Ones, and he as a Holy One will not be abandoned, verse 10. That's an impressive extent of trust. God has the power to stop death. Okay? Do we believe that? We believe that God can raise the dead. Did David believe that? Well, he wrote it. Verse 11, he says, you will make known to me the path of life. That's the opposite of death. In your presence is fullness of joy. There's that idea again. Because he keeps God's presence before him, he will have joy in God's presence. Because God was at his right hand, verse 11, in your right hand, there are pleasures forevermore. He will find eternal pleasures in God's right hand. And this psalm kind of comes together, you know, taking trust in God by keeping focused on him and keeping his presence before you so that you can be in his presence forever. But there's just one thing about this psalm. It's the promise that it makes, the level of trust that it claims in escape from death. It doesn't work unless you have a resurrection from the dead. Which is why Psalm 16 was a favorite of the apostles. It really was. It's quoted by both Peter and Paul in their sermons in the book of Acts. It was a favorite of theirs. And what I want to do is I want to look at how this psalm is used in the New Testament and what it really means. Let's start with Acts chapter 2. In Acts chapter 2, men of Israel, I'm starting in verse 22, by the way. Peter is giving his sermon. I'm not going to read the whole sermon, but in verse 22, Peter writes, "Men of Israel, listen to these words. Jesus, the Nazarene, a man attested to you by God with miracles and wonders and signs which God performed through him in your midst, just as you yourself know, this man, delivered over by the predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God, you nailed to a cross by the hands of godless men and put him to death. But God raised him up again, putting an end to the agony of death, since it was impossible for him to be held in its power." There. Of course, he goes on to quote from the psalm here. Verse 25, "For David says of him, I saw the Lord always in my presence. He is at my right hand so that I will not be shaken. Therefore my heart was glad and my tongue exulted. Moreover, my flesh also will live in hope, because you will not abandon my soul to Hades," which is their Greek equivalent of Sheol, "nor will you allow your Holy One to undergo decay. You have made known to me the ways of life. You will make me full of gladness with your presence." The verses quoted express that confidence we just read about, that God would deliver from death. And David said that. But there's a problem. And the problem comes up in verse 29. "Brethren, I may confidently say to you regarding the patriarch David that he both died and was buried, and his tomb is with us to this day." David trusted God not to abandon him to the grave. And David is dead. Is the trust of God not working? Does the trust of God lead anywhere? How do you explain Psalm 16? Is it just a piece of wishful thinking? Was David's confidence misplaced? Did God make a promise he didn't plan to keep? Or was God hinting at something else all along? Of course, Peter goes on to say that the wording of the psalm demands more than what we see in David's life. It was not just a song that they sang. It was the words of a prophet who was looking ahead. In verse 30, because he was a prophet and knew that God had sworn to him with an oath to seat one of his descendants on the throne, he looked ahead and spoke of the resurrection of the Christ, that he was neither abandoned to Hades, nor did his flesh suffer decay. This Jesus God raised up again, to which we are all witnesses. David knew all along God was going to put a descendant of his on the throne. He looked ahead. He saw that descendant resurrected. That's the promise of God. David speaks not just on his own behalf, that the Lord would not abandon him to Sheol, but he speaks even on behalf of the Messiah, the Son of David, the Son of God, who would be on the throne and who would not be abandoned to Hades or undergo decay. The apostles are all witnesses of the fact that God himself raised Jesus from the dead. Now, this is fascinating to look at for me. Peter's use of Psalm 16 is a helpful key, not just to understanding this one psalm, but really to understanding many of the psalms, most of the psalms, and a lot of messianic ideas that we find in the Old Testament. Sometimes I hear brethren say, well, Psalm 16 is a messianic psalm. That's true. I'm still searching in vain for the psalm that is not a messianic psalm. I haven't been able to find it yet. Have you? The New Testament is not an exhaustive commentary on the Old Testament. It doesn't tell us the meaning of every single passage individually. But it does show us how Christ is the key to the whole thing. And it gets us to see him in more places. And, you know, the people who are listening to Peter's sermon, they were supposed to hear this connection. He quotes this song that they sing in their synagogues and in their temple over and over. It says that's actually talking about Jesus. It gets you to go back and say, well, wait, was Psalm 2 talking about Jesus? Was Psalm 21 talking about Jesus? Was Psalm 132 talking about Jesus? Etc., etc. And numerous, this idea is all over the place, over and over again. In fact, there are numerous passages in the Psalms that hint at this idea of eternal life. In Psalm 21 in verse 4, for instance, David writes of the king, "He asked life of you. You gave it to him. Length of days forever and ever." That's a pretty tall order for a king that died. But here he describes eternal life. Or you read Psalm 30 in verse 3. "O Lord, you have brought up my soul from Sheol. You have kept me alive that I would not go down to the pit." That sound like resurrection to you? Brought back to life? Kept alive? Preserved? I mean, David's died and he's still dead, but he wrote those words. Psalm 34, verses 20 through 22. "He keeps all his bones. Not one of them is broken. Evil shall slay the wicked, and those who hate the righteous will be condemned. The Lord redeems the soul of his servants. And none of those who take refuge in him will be condemned." None of those who take refuge in him will be condemned? None of them will be condemned to what? Ultimately, to those, ultimately in the context of the psalm, to death. But David died. And again, we're confronted with this idea, you know, that they're not going to die. They're not going to die. There's going to be eternal life. How do you deal with that? The promises of God. Well, the answer that the New Testament gives, the answer that the apostles give, is that these psalms were looking ahead to Jesus and to the resurrection of the dead. Acts chapter 13 is the other place where Psalm 16 is quoted. Acts 13, here we find it in a sermon of Paul's. And again, you know, Paul's logic is very similar to Peter's, with a couple different things he does. Beginning in verse 26, "Brethren, sons of Abraham's family, and those among you who fear God, to us the message of this salvation has been sent for those who live in Jerusalem and their rulers, recognizing neither him nor the utterances of the prophets which are read every Sabbath, fulfilled these by condemning him, and though they found no ground for putting him to death, they asked Pilate that he be executed. When they had carried out all that was written concerning him, they took him down from the cross and laid him in the tomb. But God raised him from the dead. And for many days he appeared to those who came up with him from Galilee to Jerusalem, the very ones who are now his witnesses to the people, and we preach to you the good news of the promise made to the fathers, that God has fulfilled this promise to our children, in that he raised up Jesus." And here we have a string of quotations. "As it is also written in the second psalm, 'You are my son, today I have begotten you.' As for the fact that he raised him up from the dead, no longer to return to decay, he has spoken in this way, quote, 'I will give you the holy and sure blessings of David.' And verse 35, 'Therefore he also says in another psalm, 'You will not allow your Holy One to undergo decay.'" And there we have a quote from Psalm 2 and verse 7. Only time the New Testament quotes the Old Testament and actually puts a number on the chapter. Interesting. The installment here of God's Messiah as king meant that he couldn't be defeated or destroyed. If he was destroyed, then the statement, "You are my son, today I have begotten you," demands his resurrection. The statement in verse 34 is a quote from Isaiah 55 in verse 3. "I will give you all the holy and sure blessings of David." Which is a reference to the fact that, you know, God was going to give the Davidic covenant to David and his descendants forever and ever and ever. Well, forever is a pretty long time. It's not like the Mosaic covenant. That was temporary. It's an everlasting covenant. It necessitates things. And if it's truly everlasting, what does it necessitate? Resurrection? Immortality? A new life? And of course, what he says here, I will give you. You is not singular there. It's y'all. It's you plural. So there's a sense, of course, in which all of God's people are made to be heirs of the Davidic covenant and receive the holy and sure blessings of David. If we are to reign with Christ, of course, this demands not just his resurrection, but ours as well. And then, of course, the quote from Psalm 16, where he makes this argument, "You will not allow your Holy One to undergo decay." Verse 36, "For David, after he had served the purpose of God in his own generation, fell asleep and was laid among his fathers and underwent decay." So much for the psalm, right? No. Verse 37, but he whom God raised did not undergo decay. Therefore, let it be known to you, brethren, that through him forgiveness of sins is proclaimed to you, and through him everyone who believes is freed from all things from which you could not be freed through the law of Moses. So we bringing this back around to the close. You know, the Psalm of Trust, Psalm 16, these statements of trust. Was David's trust personally misplaced? Did Psalm 16 not apply to David? Well, no, it did. He had reason to trust God. But the wording of Psalm 16, as with so many other Old Testament texts, the wording demands more. If God is truly faithful, truly trustworthy, truly worthy of the kind of praise and trust that David heaps upon him here, then the resurrection of Jesus becomes necessary. Psalm 16 applied in a greater way. Jesus, who really was not abandoned to Sheol, who really was not allowed to undergo decay, who really did receive length of days forever and ever. But it doesn't stop there even. It also applies to us. Us who are holy ones. Us who are heirs of Christ. If we are saints and we are holy ones, He will not allow His holy ones to undergo decay. He will restore us too from the dead. He will not allow death to be the end of us. He will show us the path of life. This is why the New Testament describes Jesus not just as resurrected, but as the first fruits of the resurrection. 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 20. Take out your songbooks as we begin or conclude this lesson. The level of trust that David displays is incredible. But it's not just one man from 3,000 years ago displaying trust. He's setting a pattern for how we, too, are to trust the Lord. These things were not written for their benefit only, but also for our benefit. Because Jesus, He was delivered over for our transgressions and raised for our justification. He lived and died and lived again so that we could live our lives for Him, so that we could give our lives for Him, and so that we could rise again to spend eternity in His presence. You love the presence of the Lord. You trust in Him to fulfill the promises that He has made. Are you living a life that reflects those promises, that keeps the Lord always before you in your presence as a source of joy, a source of trust? And if not, you need to make your life right with the Lord. Now is as good a time as any to make that need known, while together we stand and we sing the song that He selected.